Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors this week. Environments for Humans, promoting their online summit, the RWD Summit. That's Responsive Web Design Summit, coming up this April 1st through 3rd. It's a three-day party of responsive web design. Coupon code Shop Talk Show gets 20% off there. And my favorite web host, Media Temple. CSS Tricks and Shop Talk Show have been media on Media Temple for years now. Use coupon code SHOPTALK for 25% off of that, and we'll tell you more about both of those things later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast about front-end web design, development, skateboards, Ninja Turtles, Turtle fan art.
Mm-hmm. I like how Rupert Dave says front-end at the thing that we just got an email from someone that was like, you guys are really dropping the ball on back-end stuff, and we're like, yeah, that's because we're a front-end show, and that's it. Okay.
Front-end show. Well, let's back-end talk. Here, let's database.
Uh-huh.
SQL.
It. Boom. Ruby.
MVC. Boom.
Nailed it. Okay. With us today, Louis Lazarus. Hey, Louis, how you doing?
Hey, how you guys doing? This is great. This is like being on the Conan O'Brien of web development. This is
less comfortable chairs.
That makes me Andy Richter, doesn't it?
Yes.
I guess something like that.
That's achievement unlocked.
Chris and Dave, have you seen when they do that on?
is it dog photos where the mouths talk over dogs? Isn't that a Jay Leno thing? Anyway, I quit.
Louis is Impressive Webs. So if you've ever been to the blog impressivewebs.com, that's Louis. Twitter is Impressive Webs. That's kind of your handle around the world.
Yeah. It's an old name that I picked because I wanted impressivewebsites.com like in 1999, but it wasn't available, so that was the next best thing.
Yeah, so it's like it's plural in that way that when people pluralize math and they say maths, what is that about? Is that just like the international way to say math? I feel like we don't say maths.
Yeah, that's how they do it in the UK apparently.
Yeah. Anyway, total aside there, and then a more recent project is Web Tools Weekly, right? So literally a email newsletter.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I'm really excited about how that's going. It's fun. It's a lot of work, but it's fun.
It does. It looks like a lot of work. I get it every single week, and not only is it a roundup of like all like repos, and there's always stuff that you haven't seen in there, right? Because I feel like everybody, whatever you see, you feel like everybody's seen, but then when you see a list of like, here's what happened on the web last week, I'm always like, I didn't see any of that. And that's what it's like reading Web Tools Weekly. There's always like 15 things in there, and I haven't seen any of them, I feel like.
Yeah, and it's not just recent stuff. Like, some of it's been around for a bit, but it just kind of categorized stuff that I haven't included yet.
Sure, there might be a theme or something, right? We might list like three things that are related to each other or whatever, yeah. And not only that it starts out with content that's not published anywhere else, right? It's like some kind of like, here's how like selection range works in JavaScript, and that's the top of the article, so.
Yeah, and actually, that was just something that I read from Adi Osmani. He said one time a while back, I don't even know if you would remember saying this, but he said, if you're going to do a newsletter, don't just do a list. Add something to it that's unique, some content, and not just, mm-hmm. I don't like the whole intro of, hey, here's what's happening in my life sort of thing. You know, I just want to give them something that they can use, something practical, and get to the big roundup.
Well, that's nice. I hope it I mean, everybody should sign up for it. It's at webtoolsweekly.com, and I think there's a link to it from Impressive Webs too. So if you want to check it out from there, yeah, it's highly worth doing, especially for the stuff at the top, because it's always some like raw JavaScript good stuff that might. I feel like that's good stuff recently. I hope it works out. It's doesn't it seem tempting to like move it over to a blog at some point for the SEO value of the?
Yeah, no. Well, I'm looking into the possibility of just throwing them on Impressive Webs as individual posts, maybe just for weekends or something like that. Or I'm thinking of wrapping it all up in like an ebook and just selling it for a couple of bucks.
Sure. That makes sense, because you've done that before. That's one of the books that you've created is like, here's some of the CSS content that I've posted on Impressive Web.
Yeah, and it'll be cheap. It'll be like, I don't know, $3 for the whole thing or something.
Has that worked out for, I mean, because it was, I'm assuming that when you did this for CSS, it was a bit of an experiment as far as...
Yeah.
One. And the cheap thing worked out well enough that you would do it again?
Good, yeah. You couldn't make a living off it, but it was a nice little extra bit of money to kind of support the newsletter. Yeah.
Cool. Good. So it's not like, I feel like, I don't know, like what if you made it like 25 bucks? What if you like did the exact opposite thing and you...
I don't know. I have no idea. It's funny. These things work funny. You'd have to...
Yeah. Just feel a little better.
Marketing expert or something.
Oh, so if you still haven't heard of Louis,
what's your net worth? I'm just kidding. Since we're talking financial stuff.
Yeah, I'll have to get back to you on that. Yeah.
That's cool.
I got to count all the Lambos.
not as much as Chris's, let's just put it that way.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
The Lambo has depreciated a little bit.
If you still haven't heard of Louis, you maybe have heard of him because you use what everybody is using these days to start new projects, which was the HTML9 responsive boiler strap JS.
This was revolutionary, man. Tell us about how you made it, how you came up with it.
Well, yeah, it's just, you know, the web needs a new framework every week, so that was my contribution.
And I like, so if you go to HTML9 responsive boiler strap js.com, it's got everything you need to know about it.
But I didn't know you guys would remember that, but anyway.
Oh, this is great. So, and you know, question number four was the first question I had was, can I install it as a node gem?
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's see. I haven't updated the frequently asked questions in a while. But it works in Rube Goldberg 2.3 now, but will not autocompile Freeway, ButtMonkey, Merge, SVN, Commit, Share, Java Hunk.
That's good. Java. So important to support Java Hunk these days.
Oh, man. That was just my view of the industry at that time, in a good way, though.
It still feels like that. Almost worse, possibly, with the... Anyway, I feel like some grunt gulp showdown is going to happen on this, because that's like the latest funny one. I want to throw some shout-outs. We've had shows with Nicole Sullivan on and Ben Schwarz on them, and both of them happen to be running CSS Focus Conference, so I thought I'd give a shout-out to them. Ben's is in Melbourne, Australia. I think it's in Melbourne. It's in Australia for sure. CSSConf.au. So I'm just giving them a shout out because, you know, they could. Thanks for being on the show. Keep up the good work kind of stuff. I wish I could go to that one. And I wish I could go to both of these, really. 2014.cssconf.com is Nicole Sullivan's conference, too. So shout out to them. If you love CSS, go to their CSS-focused conferences. Let's do some Q&A. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, hold on. Did we want to kick it off with a little bit of drama?
Did you dig some up? What do you got?
Well, Louis over here.
Oh.
Wrote a post on his Impressive Webs. About W3 schools.
Nice.
Great job.
I'm not good. Oh, here.
Oh, my.
That's the right one.
So let's just let Louis intro it. How about you wrote the article? What was the deal?
It was just, I don't even know why or how I came up with the idea. It was pretty spur of the moment just 2 days ago. I don't know. I guess I was just...
That's what happens to me too, right? Like a moment of inspiration, you're like, this would make a good article, and then you just do it, right?
Yeah, I think it kind of started with just, why does W3 School still have the .asp after all this time? And I mean, that kind of got explained a little bit in the comments and on Hacker News, but you know, I was just like, well, how many other things are they doing that's really bad? So I just started viewing source and just going through, and I thought, you know, that would make an interesting article, and then I could put a positive spin on it by just linking to a few things that showed the right practices. And then I realized, well, why don't I try and test their site for speed and accessibility? Maybe they're doing something right. And then I realized they are doing something right. So it turns out that it could be that they're doing the most, even though I talked about a lot of negative things and, you know, some doesn't really matter, like I mentioned.
Yeah, and some of it is just funny, yeah.
Yeah, just reflections or whatever. They're using that on their logo or whatever. But in the end, they're doing a few really good things right. And, you know, from what we've talked about in the industry of late, it seems like those might be the most important things for even for SEO. So, yeah.
You're right. You're right. So I don't know if we've ever done a deep dive into this thing. And it's everybody's got an opinion about it, because it is really true that all of us in the industry, when you Google anything, at least front endy and some my SQL and PHP stuff, because I have some of that stuff on there. And lately jQuery too, they just decided to like move over the jQuery docs to their site, which I was like, that's awful. So that's the kind of stuff that feels weird, right? Like, why do you get to do that? It feels like you're just taking your incredible SEO juice or whatever and just being like, oh, people Google this stuff, so I'll just put a copy of it on my site too, and that way I will outrank it. So far they haven't outranked the actual jQuery docs, but I, you know, matter of time, I think. So what is it? Are we 100% mad at W3 schools all the time, or do we have a more pragmatic view of this? Let's do a little round table on like your inner feelings on W3 schools.
I can go first.
Sure.
I had to install like an extension, like a blocker or whatever, like a W3 schools blocker extension, only because, you know, it would come up at the top of every single search, you know, but the results, I never knew if they were a best practice or not. So it's kind of like, I don't even want to know about it if it's not a best practice. And I tend to digest like the MDN articles a little bit better than W3 schools. So I installed a blocker. That's how I feel. I just feel like it's maybe suspect information, you know, or cause sort of like when you get the Stack Overflow one, you know, where it's like, should I what's the classic? Like, it's like, how do I do a for loop in JavaScript? And people are like, just use jQuery,
yeah.
You know,
that's sort of where, jQuery plugin to add two numbers together.
Yeah, exactly. So that's sort of where I feel. That's where I like,
yeah, Stack Overflow is universally loved.
I do like Stack Overflow. I mean, Stack Overflow is awesome for the like rando thing you had no chance at solving. So that's there's where I am. I don't know. Louis?
Yeah, for me, I don't use it. I know I see it come up in search results all the time, and it's funny because Google used to let you block it. They used to say, remove this from search results when you click the link and then hit the back button. There used to be a little link there that said,
oh, neat.
Well, and that's kind of how one of my older posts came about. I used to block them, and then they'd still come up. And then,
yeah, which, are you the one who uncovered that little tricky thing where they do, like any www.w3?
Four W's and www2, and there was dozens of them, yeah.
And somehow that circumvented it, and somehow that doesn't punish them because it punishes everybody else in the world.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. Some people were saying it doesn't punish them, and I don't know. It's weird. I once tweeted that I think Google owns W3 schools. That's the only way to explain it. But it's just, I don't know. It makes no sense to any of us.
Yeah. So and here, another weird thing is how interconnected we all are, right? We have shows like this. We talk. We know each other. We're all on Twitter chatting with each other. And it just feels like a very interconnected community. Whereas have you ever met anybody from W3 Schools? Have you ever interacted with them on Twitter? Do you know the people and the faces beyond this website? No, they're like this shadow organization of the web. It feels a little weird.
Apparently, I think I remember they did respond to the W3 Schools. W3 Fools issue when
that, did they do it publicly?
No, I think they, I might be misremembering, but I thought I remember either Paul or someone saying that they did respond to an email or something.
I think what they did do is like they largely fixed the things that were content wrong.
And they added like a little link that says, you know, report bugs or whatever.
Yeah. I actually find that most of their stuff isn't wildly incorrect. It's not like if you were to like look at every page in W3 Schools and be like, is there something that's majorly incorrect on these pages? It's not. Mostly it's correct. And these days, once in a while, I'll find a little weird one. I was, you know, and they have like pages that are just like aren't flushed out to the point where it almost feels incorrect. Like I just was learning about this weird document.implementation.has feature thing that happens to be this obscure way to test for SVG support that happens to be correct, and they have a page on it, and of course it's like not fleshed out at all, and it just says perfectly supported in all browsers, you know, and you're like, okay, you know, like
not
if you were
true.
To, yeah. Well, it's just more to it than that. Like it exists in all these browsers, but like I don't know if anyway, it's a little bit more complicated than that. I think that they have helped so many people, you know, like because they're in the top of search results, because most people don't have like a discerning eye for where they choose to get an answer on, you know, like a CSS property or something, and that largely the content is correct, they are kind of serving the world in a way. I mean, I don't know what would happen if they were just disappeared, and maybe they would land on MDN instead, and MDN would be better. Or...
Well, that's the thing. Whoever comes up first is going to be the one that you're saying, oh, they're helping everybody. Well, you know, that's just a matter of them being number one, I guess.
You're right.
I mean, you know, it's they have the exposure. It's easy. They don't need to advertise or anything. It's just top of Google for every result.
Yeah, I don't think it's evil necessarily. Is the deal there?
And in the post, they're human beings who have to feed their families. They make money, clearly.
I'm sure they can feed a whole bunch of families. You know. I always feel a little weird about that. I don't know. Like, yeah, I'm not having any particular trouble feeding the family at the moment. The other thing is W3 is weird because the organization is W3C is a very specific thing that kind of, you know, presides over the web, and they have absolutely nothing to do with each other. So I feel like
other tools that use the words W3T to have nothing.
They do. W3 Total Cache is a WordPress plugin that we all generally like. So that's fair. Another one is that
all it means is www. I mean, technically, but it just sounds like
that's
WTC.
That's true. Yeah. You're right. I didn't even think of it that way. But then there's the fact that they like offer some certification-y stuff that means nothing. You know, like what parts of their income is selling people certificates that don't matter? I don't know. Is it a lot, or is it mostly?
I think clearly we should start selling certificates here at ShopDoc.
Well, we can though. They can. That's the thing. You know, like
we should. $25 bucks gets you a ShopDoc certification. Uh-huh. You're a web pro.
We'll Photoshop your face into like a okay
into a wreath.
Anyway, it's a complicated issue. It's fun to talk about because it is such a I don't know.
And what's interesting is on the comments on Hacker News, and even a little bit, I believe, on my post as well, it almost seems like there's been a bit of a change. It's almost like it was a trend to bash them before, but now there's a whole whack of people on Hacker News, of all things, saying they're my main source, or I grew up on them. And
unbelievable. Hacker News is supportive of W3C.
Yeah, it's amazing. Oh, the top most commented posts on there, I guess the ones at the top are usually the ones that are upvoted, and they're the ones who are defending them.
How is that possible?
Yeah, I think it just kind of goes in cycles. People just don't want to follow that standard trend of hating them, and they kind of want to do the new thing. Mm. But I don't know.
I'm nostalgic for hating it again. Can we go back to that? Sorry, I know. Okay, all right, we're done with that. It's good talk.
Shut it down.
Shoot.
Next.
Let's do one question. How about that?
Let's get into the meat and potatoes of the show.
Can I just say one more thing before?
Yes, sir.
Not about that, but I forgot to mention, I don't know if you guys even know this, but I'm also working for SitePoint now.
Oh, you are?
Did you? I don't know if you guys knew that. I did not know that. Yeah, about a month ago, I'm their CSS, HTML, and mobile managing editor.
Very good. They dabble in some of that, too. At one point, they put together what was at the time, I think, probably the best, like, here's every single CSS property and some information about it. And it's relatively up-to-date, and they do a good job with it. So that would be one of those things that would step up to replace a missing W3 school, should that happen, which never will.
Yeah, and they haven't updated in a while, but that's in the works, apparently, to get...
Well, for example, that has feature property. If you look at the W3 schools one, it's incomplete and weird and tells you it's perfectly supported. If you go look at the SitePoint version of it, it says that it's supported in these browsers, which it technically is because it exists, but there's this big thing that explains that you shouldn't use it, and here's what it's for and whatever. I know that's comparing one page, but still, it was an example of where the SitePoint one was doing a better job. So,
yeah, if anyone is looking for stuff on IE8 support, it's mm-hmm. SitePoint's is a good reference. Yeah, they give you all the bugs and stuff.
Nice. All right, you want to do a question
that fits
here?
In. Yeah, let's do one. We got one from Henrik Pislin. Writes in: is there any good solution on how to run a page specific JavaScript function? Currently I'm using inline script at the bottom of the page, which inserts a page specific value to a function, which in turn checks the value with an if statement. I've heard that inline JavaScript makes the whole page uncacheable. Not sure about this, but in the case that no solution that I want, this is no solution that I want to be using. What are your thoughts and how do you solve it? Here's an example. So, there's a page load function called page one. So it's calling page load with the parameter page one. Function page load takes a page, and then if page equals equals page one, execute page one JavaScript.
So that was probably a little hard to wrap your mind around, but you can imagine a situation in which you need to run some JavaScript in which only one particular page on the site like has a value that it knows about.
And here's an example I'm
probably
working with right now.
Yeah, go on.
Is like the article page versus the home page, right? Like you have the same mm-hmm. footer on each page with some JavaScript or the same script include, but you want to run different JavaScript on the homepage and different JavaScript on the article page.
But not maintain two separate JavaScript files. The JavaScript itself is largely the same. It just has some values in it that are page specific. Mm-hmm. A common mm-hmm. one might be username, right? Like you need to know what the username of somebody is and then like send that to a JavaScript function. But from page to page, different people have different usernames. So how does the JavaScript, a front-end technology, know what that username is? Mm. I know is this getting a little too abstract? Do we explain it well enough?
Louis, does it make sense?
I'm not sure I'm following. Where are they getting the username from, you're saying?
Well, it would be back-end technology, right? Like only your back-end code knows what the current logged-in username is, right? JavaScript can't know that because it's just a static file.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could get it from the query string.
Well, that's what Henrik is asking about. What are the different ways how would you do that? You probably wouldn't put a username in a query string because that would just be weird, right?
Yeah.
Well, so you can sniff things out. I mean, right, you could sniff it out, like parse the URL and to some degree, because it would be like, you know, I go to codepen.io/davitron5000.
Sure, in that case, the username's up in the URL, so you could parse it out, yeah. I think it's more likely that what you would do, Henrik, is probably have some back-end code at the top of your inline JavaScript that is a combination of JavaScript and back-end code, right? It's like a little bit of, you just say like var username equals, and then a little snippet of PHP that echoes out with back-end code what the username is. So then on this page, you have a variable in JavaScript JavaScript named username, or you know, something smarter than that, presumably, that it is the value that the backend spit out. And now his concern about that is then that makes that HTML page uncacheable, right? Because if it cached that whole page, it would cache one person's username and not the next person's. Would that be a concern?
Yeah, I guess that would be different, huh? Different HTML.
Right.
So, yeah. Uh-oh.
I would just probably not cache that HTML. I mean, cached HTML, I don't know, like, you're logged in. So I think usually when you're...
You would automatically get the newer version, wouldn't it? Even if caching was in play, I believe. That's what I would assume, just because it changes when the user comes in, right? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a different
set. I think the only way, if you want to avoid that caching, the only way is to stash in a cookie, which are fun, or like a parameter either in the URL or the query string or whatever, just because you're going to have to, you have to sniff something out dynamically, and those would be the only two dynamic bits that wouldn't alter your HTML. Does that make sense? I mean, that would be how, like,
right.
You know, I'm drawing a blank, Backbone or something like that. It would sniff out a parameter and, you know, alter the URL and call the right template, the view, based on what the URL is telling it. Mm-hmm. So
the page caching thing is an issue, because that would even affect that a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know, not if it's URL based, but I'm imagining like the URL, there's a limited amount of stuff that can be in that URL. So what if you need like 50 variables? For example, we need something like that on CodePen. CodePen's a fairly complicated app. There's all kinds of stuff that we need access to in JavaScript that we need from the back end. The way mm-hmm. that we do it is that we have this specific little back end way that we have a hidden input on the page. It's towards the bottom of the page, and the value of that hidden input is a JSON string of all, when you can just put whatever you want in there. And then when that page loads, there's a tiny little script that runs, finds that hidden input, loops through all of the different properties that are, you know, at the base level of that JSON or whatever, and sets JavaScript variables that are equal to that property value, equal to that value. So you can have whatever you want. The backend can just spit out whatever JavaScript thinks it's going to need, and it works out pretty well. And we don't cache it, because I feel like when you're in a logged in app situation, you're not caching HTML very often. HTML caching is for like blog scenarios where the page doesn't change based on who's logged in very much. Okay. Is that enough?
Clever.
Okay.
That's clever. All right. Well, yeah.
That was as hard as it's going to get. It's going to get. let's do a sponsor.
Bring it. That might satisfy the back end people, right?
Yeah, back end guys, you happy? Awesome. Okay.
Media Temple is back as a sponsor for us. And like I said at the top of the show, it's true that that's nice. They deserve a some kind of horn situation.
They're back.
Yeah. So it's most people have heard of them probably. That GoDaddy did buy them recently, and we've talked about that in the past. There's a whole episode on that. I use them. I trust them. I like them. They have incredible support. They recently launched a big redesign of MediaTemple.com. So you can go look at that. It's cool because it's a little unusual looking for a web host, I think. It's more modern and responsive and stuff. And there was recently a post from one of the people who worked on it, who kind of front-end orchestrated the whole thing, Ara, who decided to write about it on CSS Tricks, which is really cool. And it was about how he approached it as kind of a design system. So we can link up that in the thing. But that's just, you know, that's just synergy happening there. They, you know... Between the two sites. So whatever plan you pick from Media Temple, which they have really inexpensive plans, like their $20 grid thing, you can run 100 sites on it, it auto scales, it's got all this cool stuff going on. Or what I'm more comfortable with is the dedicated virtual thing. That's what I keep all my stuff on, which is a server I kind of have more direct control over. No matter what you pick, you use coupon code SHOPTALK and you get 25% off of the first month of that. So check out SHOPTALK. I don't know. All my sites run on it. Works good. Good support.
Good Feeling stuff. Good.
All right. More.
All right. Next question comes from Bram Dehan. Question for Louis. Read your recent article on W3 schools, but the question remains, this is digging deeper, why their site still loads fast despite a million JavaScript requests. Could you elaborate on this a bit more?
It seems like they're just doing all the other things right. If you look at the YSLOW screenshot that I have in the article, everything comes up A except for make fewer HTTP requests, and clearly that's because of the scripts.
Right.
So, I don't know. It's just a YSLOW thing. With all those things that YSLOW is testing, they're ranking A and B on all of them, and so the average score is A. Each one individually, but
there's also so many things that come up with speed, right? It's not just the network tab number. So I just loaded a random one on there. There's 95 requests, which is not super low. It was 650K, which is pretty good. But the ultimate load time of the whole page was 22 seconds, which is awful. Yeah, on just one page, I just run HTML/default. It's not that bad because like we've talked about in previous episodes, it's not just the final page load time. It's how fast does it look like it's loaded? How fast can you start reading something? How fast does the top of that page look like it's kind of ready to go? Who cares about the 22 seconds if it was loading a bunch of stuff after kind of that stuff is ready to go, which it looks like they for sure were. Which a lot of it is just kind of some advertising stuff and stuff that happens afterwards. So speed is a hard question, and I think, you know, Louis's totally right. A lot of it is like some of it is solvable and some of it just doesn't matter.
This is interesting. It's maybe because they score so good, it's maybe like evidence that you should really focus on your performance and getting a good grade, because maybe that rewards you in your Googles.
Yeah, and one of the articles that I linked to, trying to find it here in the last section. It's a post by someone named Akil. I don't know his last name. It was on Medium, called "What's with Putting the CSS in the Head." Did you guys see that post?
It just like confirmed what we already knew, right? It was like, you should do that.
Yeah, not. He's not talking about linking it externally in the head. He's talking about actually putting it. Style tag.
Yeah, like figuring out what things above the fold absolutely are needed, and then put that in the style tag, and then let the other CSS load later. Yeah, that's some fancy dancing.
Yeah, and apparently he's got a grunt plugin that he's working on, and I think there's a couple of grunt plugins for that will actually do that for you. But it's just interesting because it kind of mimics inline styles. I mean, it's kind of the same thing because the CSS is right there on the page rather than externally loaded. So it's just one of those things where you look at W3 Schools and they have a lot of inline CSS. And yeah, that's been viewed for the longest time by all the standards guys as bad, you know, separation of concerns. But ultimately, it's not hurting them in SEO. It's actually, and it might be helping them.
Perhaps. It depends on how it's added, too. I mean, certainly if there was a build tool that made put those inline styles there, so the authoring was still nice, but the speed was higher, that would be cool. I kind of doubt it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think so either. Yeah.
It's like a grunt. Oh, I'm blanking. Critical CSS? Maybe? I'm going to find it. You guys go ahead.
Okay.
You guys go do things.
I had an idea. Oh, because we were talking about grunt. Oh, will it really? Well, inline CSS? That's amazing.
Just your above the fold stuff.
Just above the fold. So a server side tool somehow knows what the fold means. And
yeah. I mean,
that's immense.
You know. It's probably just like whatever. It can like simulate a render tree, what it needs to render going down.
You're right.
And just get the first 10% or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I bet you're right. It's clever.
Here's the one by Akil. Do you want me to throw that in the chat?
Sure.
I think that's the one there.
I have an idea for grunt plugin. I want somebody to help me build it, kind of. So you know how Grunticon, this is totally an aside, it's just that's what we're about. You know Grunticon, right? You have this folder of SVGs and you like drag it onto there and it makes like it makes a CSS file with data URIs of all those SVGs so that you can just use that class or whatever. That's pretty much what it does, right? Mm-hmm. And then it makes PNG fallbacks too if you need it that way, which is cool if you happen to be in a browser that doesn't support that. What I wanted to do instead or along with that is take those SVGs, folder of SVGs, and make a chunk of SVG in a defs tag. You know, in SVG, there's a tag like defs, and it just says, like, I'm not going to use these right now. I'm just defining them so that you can then call upon them later. And then later you can use SVG and use the like little like use thing and then give it an ID of one of those things that you previously defined. So what I'd like to do is take a folder full of SVGs, drag it onto some new cool task runner thing, and then get that chunk of SVG defs so that I can just put at the bottom of my HTML page so it like defers the loading of them. And then wherever I need an icon, I can just say SVG use and then the ID of that icon. So I can just use icons wherever, and they're not just SVG data URIs in which that you don't have access to through CSS. They're inline SVGs, meaning they can be replicated and moved, and yeah, I don't know, you can do all the CSS control-y stuff with CSS, which is cool. Anyway, that's my idea. I think somebody should build it because I'm too not smart to do that.
All right. Okay. So folder. Okay. Folder of SVG to defs block.
To defs block.
It. Yeah. It's called defs block.
Cool. We'll call it
all right.
Defs jam. Next. All right.
Question. You got it, Chris?
Oh, sure. Let's see. We skipped one as at the top. Is that? No, let's not do that one. Okay. Here's some pseudo hot drama we can talk about. Lee Kendall writes in, I'm interested in finding out what you think about the mobile detect PHP class. Apparently there's like one on GitHub or something. Oh no, it's just mobiledetect.net. I'm looking into solutions for swapping out and removing or removing blocks of content beyond what can be achieved with media queries, right? So conditional loadings to basically talking about like, here's this base set of HTML, but under these circumstances or on these devices, put this one out, put this one in, yada, yada, yada. My main question is, how reliable are solutions like this? As an example, I want to target all mobile devices and conditionally remove a jQuery slider in which to lighten up the weight of the page. So that's a classic thing, right? I have this desktop site. I have this big-ass jQuery carousel at the top of it. That doesn't make sense on mobile, so I just want to remove it. But you don't want to just CSS display none it, because that doesn't help a lot. It might help a little, but you're still like loading that jQuery, you know, JS, you're doing all this stuff. So Lee's like, what would be nice is if I could just have server side know that information. So I could say, don't even load that carousel JavaScript under these circumstances in which that I'm deciding that server side. So we've talked about this a little bit before, but what do you think? I mean, do we recommend a technique like mobiledetect.net or not?
Louis, do you personally,
my first reaction would be, wouldn't Match Media be a good solution for that? And you don't like, you just do it by JavaScript. Since it's a JavaScript widget he's talking about, then you don't care if it doesn't load up when there's no JavaScript enabled. So use Match Media to detect the
Match Media is front end though, right? So it would be a turn on its head.
Yeah, I think it belongs on the front end. If you think, because if you're doing it on the back end, then you kind of have to use, like it says in Mobile Detect, they use UA string detection. So you know that's kind of viewed as bad. It's not. I'm not totally against that. So.
But that's this is the exact argument that we should be having probably, right? Is that Louis saying you could to determine if it's mobile or not. Louis saying you could use Match Media. Match Media is a way to test basically CSS media queries through JavaScript, right? So you could say whatever you want. You could say max width 500 pixels or something, and if that doesn't match, it means it's lower than that, which means at least based on screen size, you've deduced that this is a mobile device, and then you could Ajax in a new script. You know, you could say, okay, then go get this script. So that's kind of a version of cutting the mustard, right? That's what they call that, which is that, like, does the browser support query selector all? Does does it, is it in color, or, you know, however many, whatever, yeah.
Yeah, someone just asked me a similar question. They wanted to, they're doing a parallax thing, and they didn't want the parallax to happen on the mobile version. So that's the same thing I recommended. I said, try Match Media. Just look at the width of the device and
right.
Don't load it up.
And so that's, in that case, that's dependent on, you know, Match Media working. So, but that's fairly well supported. I wrote about it recently in a way, this is, you know, I'm not trying to say absolutely do it one way or the other. Some people have made pretty good cases for user agent string sniffing. I think generally those are like huge, huge companies that have the time and resources and money and stuff to kind of keep that up to date. And like these little ones where you just kind of, you know, do a little regex on the string and see if it says Mozilla in it and do something, or you know what I mean, those not robust like regex tests of the UA string can get you into trouble. They've gotten me into trouble before, and I generally don't like that. I've written one little thing about how you can just let the page load once, then if you don't have a particular cookie available, just name it whatever, run some JavaScript tests, run window.width and run those type of things, which there is no browser support problems with generally, and then save that information through JavaScript to the cookie, and then the next time the page loads, you can use that cookie to know all this information about what the browser is like. And now you have to make other decisions, like how long do you keep around that cookie? Do I want to refresh the page or not when they don't have that? And how important is that kind of stuff? What if they don't allow cookies at all? And that kind of thing. But it would have a little bit deeper support of than Match Media would. So there's a million different ways to do it.
For me, it's like, if you're going to do mobile detection, you're creating, like, you're targeting an iPhone. You say, I want this iPhone to get a different experience. I want to do this for iPhone or whatever. Now you're creating this logic tree in rendering the page, you know, that, mm-hmm. that is now exists on the server. So, you know, what if iPhone 10 comes out and it has flash or whatever. Now your tree is going to have to become a little more complicated. And there's, I just feel like you're, when people talk about like, oh, for this device, we'll do this. You start creating this tree of complexity inside your web page. And that's okay if you have a team of 20 enterprise developers who are ready to manage that. But if you are just like a one person shop, like, man, that it just seems like you're starting down a path where you're trying to make an optimization, like a targeted optimization, which is a good thing to do. But, you know, unless you're going to be 100% right all the time, it just seems like you're adding some complexity to the back end of your website. That's me.
So sometimes you want it there, and sometimes you want it in the front. I think this jQuery slider or carousel thing is great for Louis' idea. Just, you know, do a cut the mustard with Match Media, and then conditionally load the new pieces that you need, and then that logic tree is a front end logic tree instead of a back end one. I've found that sometimes I want it to be back end. Sometimes I want to load literally a different template, a different mm-hmm. JavaScript, different CSS. I want it to be 100% different. Sometimes I just need that. And my common use case for that is the CodePen editor, which is just 100% mm-hmm. different than the desktop editor. So I need everything different. And I'd prefer that to just be a split on the server side. So
that makes it easier for you.
It's not perfect, and I might change it over time, and maybe I could do approach it a bit of a different way and do a really early cut the mustard and then start Ajaxing in the different components and make it a server-side tree. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it's like, do you want a client-side tree or a server-side tree?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I will choose client-side because I work on client-side and build client-side mostly, but I don't know. That's just my situation, man.
I think,
holy cow.
I think we have too many back end questions here. So
look at this. This just in. Editorially is shutting down. Did you see that? Holy cow.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I thought it was cool. People liked it. I liked using it, and they're just gonna call it.
Calling.
Wow.
Jeez. Oh, that's sad. Huh.
That's right. Fresh off the heels of yesterday. There was a List Apart article that was like, we want to embed CodePens, which I'm like, awesome. And they did in an article, but then they're like, but what if CodePen shuts down? Well, how are we going to handle that? And so they brought up an article about how they plan to handle that, which is really cool and smart, and I totally agree with it. But it felt weird to like read an article online about your service shutting down when we have absolutely no plans to do that. And I feel super strongly that whatever happens, that's not an option. You know, it's like one of my core principles, I feel like, on building the thing. So I wrote an article that kind of explained where I was coming from that way. So this is on the heels of that little drama this week.
No, that is interesting. What do you do when services close? I think it's a very important thing to keep in your mind, you know, like when you're designing an application or something like that.
Yeah. Like, I think it comes from, we have people to pay, right? So maybe that's where they're at, is they took a bunch of funding. They have a bunch of actual employees that work on this thing that they need to sustain. And where we have employees, but we're all just founders, right? Like we realize that this was going to be a slow burn up, and we're not going to hire anybody until we can pay them for the long haul kind of thing. It's not like they did it poorly. It's just a different approach to that. Like if we were to take a bunch of money right now and hire a whole bunch of people, we're that's the risk that we're taking, is that we fail to get to the point where we're sustainable, that we can pay them over time, and that would be that moment that we'd have to shut down because we built something that cannot be maintained with fewer people than we hired, which is probably what's going on here. I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to read too much into it, but it's a little sad.
Yeah. Anyway, well, there you go.
Let's do another sponsor. Do you mind? I feel like I'm talking too much. Let's pick one. I'm going to do one more. There's the Responsive Web Design Summit. So the Environments for Humans, longtime sponsor of Shop Talk Show, does these online summits so that you can attend them from your computer and use Adobe Connect because it's just good, reliable software that tends to work for this kind of thing. You look at the speaker. They put up their slides. You watch them go through the slides just like you would at an irregular conference. You interact with people in a chat room, which is actually, I find, more interactive than live conferences can be, where mostly people just shut up. This, you can like talk through the whole thing because, you know, you're not actually being distracting. You're just participating in a chat room, which is kind of cool. So this one's going to be 3 days talking all about the stuff that we were just talking about, all that stuff about how do you conditionally load content? What are the pluses and minuses of doing it on the server versus the client? I'm surely there'll be deep discussions about this stuff happening at the Responsive Web Design Summit. That URL again is rwdsummit.com, coming up April 1st, 2nd, 3rd. You can buy any combination of those days, all of them, one of them, two of them, whatever. People like Dan Mall, Brad Frost, Trent Walton. Dave, are you doing it?
I will be there.
Dave's doing it. You can save 20% off any combo of those tickets by using coupon code SHOPTALKSHOW. And, we have a... This is news. We have a 3-day pass to give away. So one of you lucky people get to go to this thing for free. Pretty exciting. And let's do the classic way. So in order to be entered to win this free ticket for the Responsive Web Design Summit, you just have to send us an audio something. Just send us a question, ideally, because then it's easier to use it for the show. Or you have a comment about something we previously talked about. You have a comment about something totally random. You have just anything that you want to, that could be potentially played by us on air. Just an audio something, because it feels like more interesting shows.
But let me give you some radio tips real quick.
Okay.
Keep it under, shoot for like a minute.
Less.
Or
20
less.
To 30 like, seconds. That's even
that
feels
like.
Into
the 2-minute thing, feeling kind of long in the tooth there.
Yep. Anyway, so short, and then just because it's an email, that's weird, but still like hashtag it just so we know that you're entering for it. Put like hashtag RWD in it or something so that then I can search my email and find them all at the end. So record something audio, a question ideally, send it in, and we'll enter you to win a 3-day pass for the Responsive Web Design Summit. Let's do another question.
All right, here we go. This one's from Ben Joyce. I really want to use icon fonts. However, 85% of our users are on Windows, and almost every icon looks terrible. Womp womp. All right. Web fonts in general don't seem to make the cut for what I consider acceptable in every browser on Windows. Have you come across any solutions to the Windows font icon problem or font smoothing in general? WebKit font smoothing isn't working either. Your show and the work you do is awesome and keeps me excited to be working on the web. Thank
Louis
you very much.
Louis is on a Windows machine right now. So do you find that when you go to websites that use icon fonts, they look like barf?
No, the only thing that... No, I don't... I've never seen that problem. I'm not sure what... Are they saying they look jaggedy and stuff?
I would say, yeah. It says terrible
crunchy,
was the descriptive
crunchy.
Word. Yeah.
The only thing I know... I use Chrome, and the only thing I notice is sometimes Chrome doesn't display special characters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like... you know, people will put little... stuff in Twitter and stuff. It's
oh right,
but it's like
a little plane icon or whatever.
It shows up like a square in Chrome, but if you look at it in Firefox, it actually shows up like the bat symbol or something or whatever it is. That
right,
I can't remember. It was something, but yeah, I see that, but not.
That's funny that you say Chrome too, because I've heard that that's like kind of the worst combination is the Chrome plus Windows thing that uses some weird thing.
Are you on Windows 8? Or 7.
Yeah, I can't stand Windows 8. Pretty annoying.
I noticed it got a little better with Windows 8. I think they like enabled clear type by default in Windows 8, or whatever their type thing is. I think Chrome on Windows is typically the biggest problem with any kind of font, like just its rendering. I think fonts are a big priority for Chrome, I think, this year, getting them to load fast, getting them to look good. So I think it'll fix itself, Ben. So that's where I'm at. Like,
I've even seen like where there's not even a character there in Firefox, but in Chrome there's a square representing a character. Like, there's nothing there.
Like Unicode just quit.
We've all seen that. You know what's funny is if you want the square, it's hard to find. I was like,
if you want to show somebody something.
Like an empty checkbox.
I know there's...
Right, exactly.
There is bug reports, I believe, on Chromium.
I've heard this. It's a real thing, Ben. Clearly it is. I mean, you're seeing it with your eyeballs, so it's real.
That's related to the icon fonts. I've never seen a problem with icon fonts myself. But
one thing that I want to be clear about here, though, and we're perpetuating the myth here a little bit, is that we say icon fonts, like there's some special thing that's different than a font. They're not. It's just an at font face font that where the glyphs in it are happen to be icons. There's nothing inherently different about an icon font than any other at font face font. I mean, maybe we could get into some very nerdy specific details about how they're set up spacing wise or kerning or something, or and how they're hinted or something like that. But inherently, they're the same. So don't think of them as different. Don't think of this icon font as this different universe. That's all I guess I wanted to say about that.
Yeah. I think it's maybe because you're trying to, like, you know, you have a house, you want to get the ridge of the house and the door, you know, just looking crisp and stuff. That's probably not going to work as well on, like, a browser that doesn't have really good anti-aliasing. And that also, it also depends on the font you used. Did you use a font that was optimized with really good hinting and anti-aliasing and stuff like that? You know, if you didn't, then it's gonna, like, there's quality in fonts too, like when you download from DAW fonts or whatever, which is totally acceptable if you're into that sort of thing. No, if you download from DAW fonts, like, it's probably not going to be optimized for the web and have the right hinting, so that's something to consider too.
Now, did they say in the question that they had problems with this in all cases of icon fonts or just in a few? Did they specify that? I forget.
Almost every icon looks terrible. Web fonts in general don't seem to make the cut.
That's a good question, though. Like, maybe, like, you didn't say which. Was it Font Awesome, or was it, like, one of the stuff from IcoMoon, which includes some of that stuff, I think? Because I think they both just use kind of open-source libraries of fonts. Or did you find one off DaFont and switch it over? Maybe you might want to try different ones. That's a good point. Or was that what you meant?
No, I was just wondering if they were specifying that it always happens on Windows and never on Mac or whatever. Or is it...
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know. Because, like, I mean, I'm looking at one of my sites where I'm using those little browser icons as an icon font, and they look fine. I'm on Windows, on Chrome.
Maybe Ben has super high standards or something.
Yeah, that could be it.
He's like...
Yeah, and you're just not discerning enough, Louis.
Yeah, exactly.
I always am like, it'll get better in, like, you know, like, maybe it's not better than a PNG right now or something like that, but it will be eventually. And if it makes your life better, but I don't know. Business decision. 85% Windows, that's a lot. So,
well, of their users, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're looking at your own stats, too. I'm plus one on that. Do you use SaaS, Louis, or no?
No, I'm just one of those. I love it, and I highly recommend it. I've written a few things about it, and actually, Hugo Girardel, I don't know if he's in the chat room. Yeah, he is. But he wrote a couple of articles for SitePoint that we published on SaaS.
Oh, nice.
I think
he's like the man in SaaS, but like in the deepest, deepest way. Like, I wrote a SaaS parser. It's like, what? That's amazing.
He's awesome. His SaaS stuff is amazing. But for me, it's just a matter of, like, I don't work on as many client sites now as I did. You know, if I was still working in an agency like I was 2008 or so, for sure I'd be using SaaS. I'm just not doing that anymore, so...
Sure, yeah. I was trying to pick which question to do, so let's not do the SaaS one.
Oh, you can do that if you want.
No,
People love SaaS.
It's okay.
I want to learn something. No.
We're here for you. God, maybe I feel like maybe we should do it now that we talked about it. And Hugo's in the room, so he could set us straight about this stuff. Okay, here, well, let's try it. Dave, can you do the name? Because it says, I would say Rene, but is that different?
Yeah, I think it's Rene Ruiz.
Okay, good. Just specified that it's a man, so I don't know if that changed that's how you say
Rene.
Anyway.
Rene. I think that's still... Fix it. Okay.
The question is, I am enjoying learning SaaS, but one of the things I can't wrap my head around is the use case for lists. What would you use stuff in a SaaS list? And what he's talking about there is you can make a list of comma-separated values as a variable. So you know that SaaS is variables, everybody says that. You could make it a color or a string or a number. The other thing you can do is make it a comma-separated list of those things. You can just go value, comma, value, comma, value, comma, value. And he's asking, what, why? Why would you ever do that?
Wow. Don't know. Why?
So
I've never done it. This is interesting.
I was trying to think about it, and I was like, okay, I think it's just like a more convenient way to store, you know, let's say you had like a list of fun colors or a list of grays or something.
That is exactly what I was just thinking of. Right, you have gray, and you try to name them. You're like light gray, medium gray, purple gray, and it's so stupid. Like,
sure.
You might as well just go gray and just like pick the gray you want, one, two, or three, right?
Sure, that's an example. And maybe it matters how many things are in the list. So you have you're going to write like a column maker, a grid maker, and you could be like, I want, you know, 100, 200, 100. So make me a column like that, like loop through them and see what the values are and then make a grid based on those three values. So I think it's just a more convenient way. It's like, I guess you would use it in the same way you would use an array, I guess, in any other language, right? It's like it just makes more sense programmatically to store things in that way. Probably slightly more useful for people that build componentry for SaaS. Right? Mm-hmm. Like a plugins and complicated SaaS-y stuff, whereas like day-to-day authoring, I don't find myself using lists all that often. Mm-hmm. Hugo says, imagine a world without arrays.
That'll be next for Hugo. What? How to use lists. I'm going to commission him to do that.
I think he's written plenty of stuff about that already. But you should. Just the world needs more. All right, I think that brings us about there, Dave.
Yeah, I think we'll land this plane here. But, Louis, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. Before we go, once again, how can people follow you, get in touch with you, buy your products, give you money? And then what is, like, one big thing you kind of want to plug?
People can find me. They know where to find me. You know what? I wanted to give a piece of advice to people. rather than a plug or whatever. You know, we get really obsessed with our industry. We do a lot. I think a lot of those who are kind of single guys and girls, they have a lot of time and they can do a lot of things. But, you know, if you have a family, if you have kids, if you have responsibilities outside of web development, my advice is don't obsess over it so much that you neglect those things. You know, spend some time with your kids. It's a pretty bad world out there. Teach them the right values and don't worry about that plug-in you're working on. You'll get it done eventually.
I think it would be funny if Dave's kid started crying from the background.
It's a
shut up.
I don't have kids. I have a wife, but I don't have kids. So
that's very lovely message.
That was a good. Yeah, I don't think we can end it better than that. That really appreciate that. And thank everyone for listening, downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to rate us a 5 in your favorite little store there. And we tried real hard to get into the PlayStation store. Not sure how to do it. If anyone has some tips, let us know. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for all the latest updates. And Chris, do you got anything else for us?
Net awards and choptalkshow.com.
Oh, net awards. That's important. We got to win that one. Guys, rally. Net awards now. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. I'm going to take us off air. Really, let's do this. Find that button here. Stop broadcast. Boom.